The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Strange and spooky. We're strapping on our helmets and setting sail on our longboats. Our mission? To reach some new territory and plunder it for all it's worth. But our target today is not some unsuspecting village, but the Viking poem known as the Völuspá. We're going to meet a guide who will show us the way, and we'll attack this little poem. Show it we mean business, and bring home whatever loot we can store in our minds. Viking poetry, today, on the History of Literature. Okay, here we go. I'm Jack Wilson. Welcome to the show. Viking poetry. What a great topic for an episode. We're going to be joined by Noah Tetzner today, host of the wonderful History of Vikings podcast. We'll hear all about the great poem, the Völuspá, one of the foundational poems in Nordic culture. The Völuspá sets out the mythology of the Vikings, from the creation of the universe to the prophecy of Ragnarok, or the Twilight of the Gods period. So interesting and so much fun. But first, I wanted to thank everyone for wishing me a happy 150 episodes. The History of Literature podcast just keeps chugging along. 150 episodes. That's quite a few. And for all of you who keep asking, who want to know just how exactly I'm dealing with all of the success that the podcast has brought me, I have to say, well, here's where I would say something modest, like, I'm still the same old Jack, and that kind of thing. But the one expression that comes to mind is one that I've always had trouble using, and I'll tell you why. What I should say here is, I'm the same old Jack, I put my pants on one leg at a time, just like everyone else. But that would be a lie. I haven't put my pants on one leg at a time for years. And in fact, somewhat surprised to hear that other people still do. I was probably in my early 20s when I really started evaluating my life. I wanted to be efficient. I had so many things I wanted to get done, and there wasn't going to be enough time to do them all. So I scrutinized my daily activities very carefully. I cut my sleep down to 3 or 4 hours per night. That was a big one. After I figured out how to save the hours, I started looking for ways to save minutes and even for ways to save seconds. Putting your pants on one leg at a time takes several extra seconds. Let's say it's 10. It's a rough estimate. 10 seconds to put that second leg on. I wear pants or shorts probably 20 days a month at least. That's 200 seconds a month. If you count pajamas, that doubles. 400 seconds a month times 12 months in a year times 50 years. You see where this is going. It's like finding an extra day or two, an extra day or two of life. So I taught myself to put my pants on two legs at a time. First, I positioned them very carefully on the floor, stepped into them and pulled them up. But of course, the positioning took a lot of time. There wasn't much savings there. So I trained myself to hold my pants with both hands, jump up, and land with my legs all the way through. It's not for everyone. I'm good, but nobody's perfect, and I'd say I probably break my nose on the floor maybe once a year on average. But even so, that's my preferred method. On those days when I'm forced by societal obligations to wear pants, I will be glad to have those extra days back at the end of my life. The more extra days I can tack on, the better. So, if you've been wondering how I've been dealing with success, let me just tell you, I'm still jumping into my pants and occasionally breaking my nose on the floor, as always. The Vikings knew what it was like to take risks, and they knew what it was like to be ruthlessly efficient. Their poetry falls into that category. It's concise and vivid and well worth reading, though it helps to have someone explaining the history, explaining the context, and explaining the subject matter. Noah Tetzner will supply all that for us after this. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor. And they're delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup. And you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Okay, joining me now is Noah Tetzner, who's here to talk about the Old Norse poem known as the Völuspá. Noah is an expert in Viking culture and mythology, and he's currently the host of the History of Vikings podcast. Noah Tetzner, welcome to the History of Literature.
Thank you so much, Jack. It's a great pleasure to be here. I love what you've done with the show and just how you have brought literature to life for so many people. So it's really a pleasure to get to have a conversation with you this evening.
Oh, thank you. So my first question is, did I pronounce the title of the poem correctly?
Yeah, that's right. The Völuspá.
The Völuspá. Okay. So before we get to the Völuspá, let's start with you. And I'm interested in your interest in the Vikings. And when did that begin?
Well, I've always been super fascinated with history, but I would say that my interest in the Vikings is more of a recent thing. And I've always loved different mythologies and just the great stories that you can see in the myths of different cultures. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I sort of discovered Norse myth, and I discovered the primary sources, the poetic Edda, which I'm sure we'll get into today, and prose Edda, and the saga of the Volsungs. And, you know, that was just super mind-blowing for me, just discovering these great works of literature, which really are sort of shadowed. Greek mythology is super popular, and that's kind of dominated the pop culture in that regard for decades, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was just, of course, taking an interest in the people behind the myths, the people who worshipped these gods and composed these stories and these oral traditions, you know, the Vikings. So I would say that my interest in the Vikings really stems from studying the Norse myths.
Yeah. Would you say we're going through kind of a Vikings moment? I mean, we have the Marvel movies that puts all of Thor and Loki into all of our minds, and there's the popular show on the History Channel, and have you seen sort of an uptick in interest in the Vikings?
Yeah, I would say there's definitely an uptick in interest, and I don't really know if that's a fad or if it's kind of a long-lasting interest that's here to stay, you know, because you look at sort of like other eras of history, like World War II, the American Civil War. Those are things which will always be popular just because there's so much, like there's just a massive amount of content and material. We have so much, we have so many sources and so many different areas to explore. So I'm curious if that will happen with the Vikings as time goes on. But yeah, with like you said, the Vikings TV show, the Marvel movies, Neil Gaiman's new best-selling book, Norse Mythology. There's just really a lot of people are taking a big interest in Vikings and Norse history, which is really exciting to see.
Right. And what led you to start the History of Vikings podcast?
Well, I've always been a big fan of podcasts in general, and especially history podcasts. And while there were a few Viking podcasts out there already, the format of my show is I always, every episode, feature a Viking or Norse mythology related, you know, expert guest. And it's a discussion-based show. And not too many history podcasts were doing that, and still not many are doing that. So I just wanted to give a lot of these scholars a platform. And I know they were very knowledgeable. And after talking with them, I've learned so much myself. And a lot of them are authors of some of my favorite history books. So it's really been a huge opportunity and just a joy to get to have conversations with a lot of my like history heroes, essentially.
Right. Well, I think the show is great, and I encourage everyone to go find it, but maybe after they listen to this one. That's the History of Vikings podcast. Okay, so who exactly were the Vikings? I know we have a lot of I go all the way back to Hagar the Horrible, and we have the horned helmets, and a lot of it has seeped into our kind of popular culture, popular understanding. But I sometimes wonder if I really have a good sense of, you know, I'm picturing men with beards, and they're rowing, and they're long ships, and they're going to plunder villages. And apart from that, there's not a whole lot that I really feel confident about. And maybe I shouldn't even be confident about that. So who were they?
Well, I think there's a big misconception about the word Viking, because actually, if we look at the word, the name Viking, it's kind of a job description in that the root word of the Old Norse, vik, combined with the rest of the word, the ing, basically what the word means in Old Norse is sort of like a pirate who lurks in a small cove or fjord. So it's very much an activity. And to go a Viking, you go raiding. And when talking about the Vikings, generally what people mean is the Norse people of the Middle Ages, the Norse men and women who lived in Scandinavia during the Middle Ages. And I guess if you sort of going along with that definition of the word, not all Norse people were Vikings, and not all I guess Vikings were Vikings, as you know, the word is kind of a job description. But I think, you know, clearly the a lot of Norse people went off raiding and pillaging and, you know, sacking monasteries and coastal villages. But I think that that is sort of an over-dramatized aspect of the of Norse history, in that oftentimes we tend to depict the Vikings as being exceptionally violent. You know, they were murdering people all the time. But if you look at the Middle Ages in retrospect, it was really just an unbelievably violent time, you know, especially with Charlemagne converting, you know, trying to force people to convert to Christianity, and just everything that was going on in the Middle Ages, the Crusades, the list goes on and on. So I don't think the Vikings were exceptionally violent. And while many Vikings did go off raiding and pillaging, a lot of them were just as concerned with putting food on the table and living agricultural lifestyles, as was so common during the time, running their farmsteads and the nobles, their estates, and et cetera. But I think that they would have been able to live a life that encompassed both existences. So perhaps they would have gone off raiding during the raiding season, and they also would have you know, looked after their families and their farms and that sort of thing.
So was the raiding just a means of subsistence? Was it sort of like foraging might be, where you go out and come back, or hunting might be, where you go out and you come back with, you know, food and treasure? Or was it for feuds and territory and some of the other things we might associate with warfare?
Right. No, I definitely think it was the first thing that you mentioned. The Vikings had a massive trading network established. It's one thing that a lot of people don't really think about when talking about Vikings, is they were actually remarkable traders. We've actually found a Buddha statue in Sweden, and it just goes, as well as Byzantium silk in England, in the Viking city of York. So it just goes to show you they had, you know, their trading networks stretched all over the globe, you know, to the Middle East and the wealthiest parts of the world at the time. The places that they would raid and that they sacked were obviously on their trade routes. So they knew these places existed, and it's not just like they all decided to get in their longboats one day and, oh, look, a monastery. No, they were very much planned raids. And the Vikings were a very intelligent people as well. A lot of people kind of tend to perceive them as being kind of stupid, but
right.
They
brutish.
Yeah, brutish. That's a good word. But they really were quite intelligent. And especially we can see that in just the myths that they told and that sort of thing.
Right. Well, that was my next question, is how did poetry fit into their lives?
Yeah, poetry had a very special place in Viking everyday life. There's different forms of poetry during the Viking Age. So there's different forms of Old Norse poetry, Old Norse, the language of the Vikings. And the two main forms are what is known as skaldic poetry and then Eddaic poetry. So Eddaic, meaning from the two Eddas, are two key sources for Norse myth, the prose Edda and the poetic Edda. And sort of the differences between those two poems or those two forms of poetry are obviously the Eddaic come from the Eddas, and we actually don't know who the author was. So those are, you know, like minstrel poems, court poet things, and passed down orally generation to generation. But then when we get into the other form of poetry, it's more of it doesn't really go into as great of detail. So there's what are known as kinnings in the forms of skaldic poetry, just sort of hinting at details. So like when referring to a ship, instead of using the word ship or boat, they would use the word like an oar or steer, or instead of using the word sword, they would use something like a wound hoe or something. So those are the two forms of poetry. And like I said, one's called skaldic poetry, and obviously that would be the job of a skald, would be to recite those poems. So they actually had a special class, just dedicated to preserving these oral traditions. And those were, of course, the skalds, which would have been the poets at the time. They would have had special places in court and, you know, in the great hall. And it was, you know, because while the Vikings did often write things down in their alphabet, the runes, we have very limited preserved runes because most of them were likely written on wood, which of course deteriorates. So a lot of what we know about Norse myth was simply passed down orally generation to generation, but then later written down by historians and Christian poets and Christian historians.
And do we know if it was it just for the leaders and the elites, or was it also part of a more of a campfire or family tradition?
That's a good question. I would say that it would be both, in that the everyday Norse person, the everyday Viking, was very aware that the gods existed, the mm-hmm. gods that we're told of in these poems. You know, it's interesting to note that, you know, many Christians display their affection for Christianity by wearing cross necklaces nowadays. But during the Viking Age, we found hundreds, just numerous amounts of Mjolnir pendants. And Mjolnir is Thor's hammer. So these pendants and necklaces that Viking men and women would wear depicting Thor's hammer, as Thor was the sort of the god of the everyday man or woman, the god of agriculture during that time.
Okay, so let's turn to the Völuspá. So what is the Völuspá, and when roughly was it written?
So the Völuspá is one of many poems that can be found in the Poetic Edda. And as mentioned before, the Poetic Edda is one of our two key sources for Norse myth. Its author is unknown, just the Poetic Edda and thus the Völuspá as well. And it is believed to have been composed, these poems, around the year 1270, somewhere mm-hmm. in there. As far as the oral tradition behind it, that could have potentially existed hundreds of years before, but a lot of people are actually content to date it much later, right around like 1000 AD, so sort of really marking the end of the Viking Age.
Mm-hmm. And this in Old Norse?
Yes, it would have been in Old Norse, the Vikings' native language.
Right. And do we know anything about the author or the circumstances of its writing, or does it appear to be a single author, or does it look like it morphed over many years through an oral tradition?
Yeah, I would say the latter. Like I said, the author is anonymous. We don't know who it is, but there's definitely sort of like variation in the different poems, whether it be the Havamal, the Völuspá, the Grimnismal, the Skrimnismal, that are all in the Poetic Edda. So it really is kind of at the influence and at the will of the person, you know, composing it, who composed those poems.
And was it preserved in some way, or how did it come down to us? Did it come down as part of the Edda, or was it that something that was compiled by later historians and scholars, or was it written down at all, or did it just survive orally until hundreds of years later, or how did that happen?
Yeah, so it survived orally, but then was later written down by historians. And the central part of the Poetic Edda, the kind of where we get it from, the writing, is from a document called the Codex Regis. And that basically is the Poetic Edda, but that's just kind of the raw manuscripts, the manuscripts that encompass all of the different poems. And those would have been, again, like minstrel poems, law court poetry, and that sort of thing.
And was that written on paper or stone, or what?
Yeah, it would have been like written on paper, manuscript. You can actually probably, for those listening, just Google Codex Regis, and you can see the old copies of the manuscripts on the paper written around 1270.
And were they kept in a, you know, through a church, or is it something that was discovered by archaeologists?
That's a good question. That's something that I'm actually curious to know as well. And I'll be having a special guest on my show, and we'll actually be talking a lot about the Völuspá. So I'd be interested to ask her that. But my instinct would be to say that the church would have a lot to do with it. As mm-hmm. the Middle Ages was progressing, the church was becoming more and more controlling over these sort of documents, you know.
Right.
But it's just a little sort of tidbit. It is interesting to note that a lot of the Christians who were put in charge of preserving these, you know, paganistic poems, especially the main one who Snorri Sturluson, who wrote the Prose Edda, actually has a very tolerant attitude towards Norse myth, which is very rare, of course, during the Middle Ages.
Yeah. Did they try to sneak a little Christianity into it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. in the Prose Edda, which is the contemporary to the Poetic Edda, I think in the prologue, Snorri writes something like, the gods Thor, Odin, and Loki are actually descendants of Troy. And actually, they went back to Scandinavia and people just started worshiping them as gods.
All right. Okay. Okay. So let's get to the poem itself. So we're, let's start with the speaker. Or if there's a narrator, or who is there sort of a character who's delivering these lines?
Yeah, so the person, the narrator delivering the lines, it's the Völuspá is also known as the Cirrus's prophecy. Mm-hmm. So there's this sort of like Cirrus witch character telling us of these poems, or telling us the story of the poem. And she's telling us how the world was created, and then also of the end times, Ragnarok. And the poem isn't very long. I think if you pick up a copy, it's only about, you know, 20 pages, few stanzas. But the poem starts off with talking about the creation of the world, and then progresses to Ragnarok, which is when the world will end and the gods will battle the frost giants, and it's the twilight of the gods. But then the world will become, you know, reborn again, and there's sort of this mythic cycle element to it as well.
Hmm. So the translation I saw called it the wise woman. You called it the witch. Is that is wise woman sort of a euphemism here?
Yeah, that's interesting. And I suppose it really depends on the translations, because the translations do tend to differ. I've just always understood it as the Cirrus's prophecy. And if you look up, you know, Cirrus, that kind of has sort of like more witch connotations to it.
Yeah.
And witch, not necessarily in like an evil witch sense, more of like somebody who has knowledge of the future.
Mm. I would say. Right. Okay. So wise woman, it sort of fits in there with that connotation of witch.
Yeah.
Okay. So we skipped over a bit. So let's walk through it a little more. It starts with the creation, ends with a vision of the future, but let's talk about what's actually in the creation. So how does it explain the creation of the universe?
Yeah, so the creation of the universe in Norse myth, in the Poetic Edda, it really doesn't give a great description of how the world is created. That's something that's described quite in depth in the other source, the Prose Edda, but it hints the creation of the world. So there's a lot of hints, what are known as I said before, kinnings. And basically how the creation of the world goes is, you know, there's this, long story short, there's this first being, the giant Ymir, who emerges from this melting ice. And then there's this cow called Eldumla, who also emerges from the frozen ice. And she nourishes Ymir with her milk. And she in turn takes nourishment from licking the salt stones on this great patch of ice in the giant gaping void, Gunnunga Gap, which was basically all that existed during that time. And there's a realm of fire and a realm of ice, and they kind of mix together, and that's how these creatures are emerged. But then eventually more people are brought out of the ice, and actually Ymir's two legs mate with each other and have children. And while he sleeps, the perspiration under his armpit also bears him more children. And those children eventually end up being Odin, the highest and mightiest of all the gods in Norse myth, and his two brothers. And they kill Ymir, and eventually they create the world out of his body. His bones are the rocks and mountains, his brains are the clouds, you know, all that sort of thing. And they create this giant world, which is the universe in Norse myth, is encompassed and understood in this gigantic ash tree called Yggdrasil. And there's nine different realms in Norse mythology, Midgard being the realm of humans, Asgard being the realm of the gods, Jotunheim being the realm of the giants, and then the dwarves and elves get their own realms, and there's the underworld of hell and the world of fire and so on.
Right. All of,
yeah.
So I had a hard time picturing what this tree was meant to be? Is it that the earth, the ground that we walk on is a part of this tree, or is it surrounding us somehow, or how exactly does that work?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to wrap your head around, isn't it? It's kind of abstract, but the entire mythic landscape in Norse myth is this tree, and the nine different realms are all encompassed in the roots and branches of this tree. Hmm. And we're even told that Odin rides his eight-legged horse Sleipnir across the branches from realm to realm. Apart from the gods, not too many like different realms interact with each other. Like, everybody sort of stays in their collective realm, unless, of course, they die and they either go to Asgard or the underworld of hell.
Hmm. So is the tree maybe, do you think of it as more like, I was picturing an actual tree that was enormous, but maybe should I be picturing it instead as more like a map, like a family tree? And it's more like a chart of where things are geographically, or...
No, I think you're right. Yeah, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? No, I think you're right to picture it as an actual tree.
Yeah.
Because even in Ragnarok, you know, the great tree is lit on fire by this great fire giant, and it burns down, but then it is again reborn. So it's very much a physical tree.
Yeah. So I guess this, this maybe goes without saying, but this is a people who lived among the forests, and this would be a very natural symbol for them to use, just as in Egypt, maybe they look to the sun or something. Here, they're impressed by the trees around them and imagining a giant tree.
Yeah, I think that's dead on. You're absolutely right.
So you had mentioned something before where you said that there were, you know, hints of all of the things that you described. And I have to say, when I went through the Poetic Edda and the Völuspá, I wasn't getting nearly as much detail as you were able to convey from your other sources. And I'm wondering, though, for the listeners, for the people who were hearing it in real time, my guess is these would have been very familiar, and maybe the hints would have been all that they needed.
Yeah, I think you're right. They definitely would have had a good understanding of how the world worked, and that they were a part of this universe with this great ash tree, because all of those traditions, all of those oral traditions were written down much later. So I think you're right. Hints would have been all that they needed to understand what these poems were getting at.
Okay. And then I can't skip over this part because I'm fascinated by it. Although I suspect a lot of readers maybe do skip over it a little bit lightly, after the creation of the universe, we come to the Catalog of the Dwarves. And it's, I don't know, six or eight stanzas that are basically names of famous historical dwarves.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think you're right. A lot of folks do tend to skip over that. Now, I don't really know, to be honest, what the significance of that is, in apart from just naming these, again, notable dwarves. Because dwarves in Norse myth are not really main characters. The main characters in the Norse myths tend to be humans, gods, and giants, but that's pretty much it. Dwarves do come into it occasionally. They're great craftsmen. They crafted Thor's hammer and Odin's spear, whose point can't be broken. But it's interesting because that's kind of one of the great ironies in Norse myth. Like, they dedicate quite a few stanzas to going through the history of these dwarves, but yet in Norse myth, they're not really talked about much.
So they're not celebrated as the sort of founding fathers, or I guess in Greek myths you might have the myths, the gods and heroes. They don't play that sort of a role.
Yeah, that's right, because the dwarves aren't really significant characters in Norse myth. The primary creatures in Norse myth are gods, giants, and humans. The dwarves certainly, you know, are mentioned throughout Norse mythology and throughout the Poetic Edda, in that, you know, they crafted Thor's, you know, indestructible hammer, Odin's spear, whose point can never be broken. And they have their own realm as well. Svartalheim is one of the nine worlds, but there's not really any myths that are centered around dwarves, except for the Meat of Poetry, which actually is quite a humorous myth. It centers around two like psychopaths, two sociopathic dwarves. But that's pretty much it. So I'm curious myself as to why these dwarves are included in the beginning of the Poetic Edda. And that's one of the things about Norse myth and the Viking Age in general is there's so much that we don't know. And there's a lot in Norse myth where everything lines up for the most part, thanks to the work of Christian historians, but there's a lot of great ironies and a lot of things where it's just like, okay, that was very random. We don't really know why that little tidbit was included there.
Yeah, maybe there was a whole line of kind of, I guess, bestseller, so to speak, oral myths about certain dwarves, and this was naming their names to the great pleasure of the audience, but the stories that they were premised on have been lost to us.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Who knows what else could be out there in terms of just Norse myth that was just lost to us, you know?
Yeah, and one thing that it did do, having this catalog, is it inspired writers like Tolkien to use the names. I saw the name Gandalf in here in the catalog of dwarves.
Yeah, that's right. Tolkien was very familiar with Norse myth. And actually, I had one of the world's leading Tolkien scholars, Tom Shippey, on my show. And we talked about that briefly in his interview. But Gandalf was certainly one of the names of the dwarves, as well as there's just a lot of similarities. I mean, if you look at Ragnarok, which is mentioned in the Völuspá, the Twilight of the Gods, the End Times in Norse myth, that actually Christopher Tolkien, the son of J.R.R. Tolkien, talks about how that was inspired. That inspired the Daggeroth, which is the great final battle in Tolkien's Legendarium and Silmarillion. It's mentioned as well. And there's definitely a lot of similarities. I know the sun and moon are destroyed. And actually at Ragnarok, the two wolves, which are perpetually chasing the sun and moon, which are driven on chariots at Ragnarok, they're engulfed and the wolves devour the sun and the moon. So there's so many similarities in Tolkien.
Right. And one of the things with the catalog of dwarves that I wondered about, whenever I see that sort of compilation or list, I mean, part of it is you wonder if they're pleasing the audience with some familiar names and some, maybe it's very melodious to hear the sounds of the names in put into the verse, or if it's trying to preserve some history, or maybe just kind of portray this as being historically accurate. You know, the more you fill things with details that sound real and sound impressive and sound thorough, maybe it gives the poem a bit of credibility as a recorded history document.
Yeah, that could very well be. And in terms of composing the myths, we don't really know we don't know much about that process.
Right. So this could have been the work of maybe a single person who interpolated these names as part of the oral process. But I guess that kind of begs the question of, what do you think motivated the poem? What is the author or the speaker of the poem trying to do?
I think that the speaker of the poem is telling us of a prophecy.
Okay.
It's the Seeress' prophecy, and she's kind of prophesying certainly the creation of the world, speaking of what has already been, but also the end of the world. So it's kind of outlining the mythic cycle in Norse mythology.
Right. And there's a part where the speaker, the wise woman, actually gives some information to Odin that only Odin would be difficult for anyone to know, to kind of gain some credibility as to her powers of being able to prophesy correctly.
Yeah, that's correct.
But what do you think the poem is up to? Do you think it's just trying to entertain people, or does it have a religious agenda, or why is it trying to explain? I mean, a creation myth, I think, has kind of an obvious motivation of trying to explain the world to people who are curious. But a prophecy seems like it could be trying to move people in a certain direction, or it could just be a good fun story. Or what's your take on what's behind this as a prophecy.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that in poetry in general to the Vikings would have been a very entertaining thing to hear these stories. Surely would have been absolutely entertaining, but it was also their religion. So as much as it was entertaining, there was also very serious spiritual connections that they you know, thought they had to these gods, which is just absolutely incredible if you think about it. Just how these myths influenced their everyday lives, I can't even imagine what it would have been like to meet a Viking. But I think that's such an excellent question, because there's multiple things that this poem is driving at. And I suppose at the same time, one could say that we really don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. Is it connected to morals or values? Does it seem like, you know, the vision, like this could be yours if you work hard, you know, sort of the way heaven might be in some religions? Or does it promote any kind of behavior in the listeners?
I don't think so, because it's interesting to note that out of all the sources, out of all the limited sources that we have for Norse myth, we don't actually have any historical evidence of how the Norse gods were worshipped. We don't know how to honor the gods. We don't know how to make a sacrifice to the gods. We don't know how to pray to the gods. So I guess another answer is, you know, we don't really know the answer to that question.
Isn't that interesting? And it's not that old. That's the thing.
Yeah, that's right.
It just, is that because it just wasn't recorded as well, or it kind of got steamrolled by Christianity?
The Vikings, if you look at just the Norse people, the Vikings kind of came onto the scene of world history very abruptly. And the Viking Age was short. It only lasted 300 years, about 793 till around like 1066, to get technical with dates. But the reason why we don't know anything about the Vikings before that is because ancient Greek and Roman explorers never really made it that far north, and certainly the Roman Empire never made it past the Germanic tribes in Germania. They never made it that far north, so we just don't know what was going on before the Vikings started raiding monasteries.
Right, and by the time this poem, for example, was recorded, the heyday had already been over for a couple of hundred years.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so we're getting just sort of, we're just seeing it, shards and fragments of the actual richness of the culture.
Yeah, it's a shame, but it certainly is interesting, and there's so many questions that are unanswered. And I hope, as archaeology continues to thrive, Viking Age archaeology, I hope that we can find more and more evidence and more answers.
Yeah, that's exciting. And it's also exciting, or, you know, it seems like the suggestiveness of it might help, you know, it kind of fuels the imagination to have these gaps.
Yeah, it really does fuel the imagination. And I think that's probably why scholars like Tolkien were so drawn by these myths, that they actually were inspired by them enough to incorporate many of their themes into, you know, Tolkien's writings, The Lord of the Rings and The Silmarillion and The Hobbit as well.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm always struck by that when we go back to this period. It feels in some ways sort of, it feels like a calling back to the past, but it also feels sort of futuristic. And it just, there's something about this period of history that feels, it feels strangely familiar in a very interesting way that I don't get when I read about ancient Romans or anything like that. It's close to us, but yet it's also a little bit harder to inhabit.
Yeah, I think you're right, because the societies of Greece and Rome were very, very well developed and very, I don't know if I would use the word civilized, but you know what I mean, very established.
Yeah.
Whereas there's very like primal elements to Norse myth, and the myths are just timeless, because while some may find it hard to relate to cold winter nights and howling wolves, these are just really like basic problems that mankind has dealt with for millennia.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So what about this poem do you think would particularly resonate with someone at the time? What do you think was registering when they were sitting down to listen. Do you think they were in a state of awe? Do you think they were laughing and enjoying the beauty of the words or the stories? Or how do you think they were responding to the poem?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think as far as the bits of Ragnarok are concerned, the mention of the end times, I think there would have just been this great feeling of awe, but also uncertainty. Because when you hear of this massive battle between the gods and the frost giants, and the whole universe is being, you know, burnt down, the Yggdrasil is set on fire, and the sun and moon are being devoured by wolves, and it's absolutely nutty. So I think I can't even imagine because these people, right, they actually believed that this stuff existed and believed that this was going to happen to them and was going to happen to the universe. I can't imagine what might have been going through their minds as they listened to these poems around a great bonfire, you know?
Do you think they believed, like they believed in the literal truth of it, or was it more like some people might have believed a little bit and others just sort of were kind of amused by it?
No, I think they definitely would have believed it. Like I said, just with the Mjolnir pendants that we've found, we've also found little statues of various Norse gods, Odin, and as well as Frey, the great fertility god. So we found a lot of and picture stones as well, depicting various scenes in the sagas and Norse myths. So they definitely were inspired by it, but in a very literal way.
Yeah. Oh, that's so fascinating. Do you think what I'm really asking is what gets religion started and the impulse behind wanting to have these answers and looking for, you know, wise people who can deliver these answers. We're so familiar with the great religions that are still in existence that to think about another set of people who are looking to a completely different set of myths to answer that questing that people have, the spiritual questing that people have, it kind of gives me chills.
Yeah, it's crazy to think about. And like you said, the great religions that are still in existence and have existed for thousands of years, there's also so many religions that have just faded away, and Norse paganism and Norse mythology is no exception. So it's just crazy to think that this influenced so many people's lives, but yet it's been all but forgotten for quite a while until recent years.
Yeah. I still find it inspiring. I guess you must as well, but it still does make me, it gives me a lot to think about, and I enjoy putting my mind in that space.
Yeah, I agree. Just reading these myths, it's absolutely inspiring. And like we talked about before, there's just really this element of, I think you said it really well, just like it was a very primal time to which all humans can relate, but also sort of futuristic. Like Ragnarok never actually happened. And, you know, these people always believed that Ragnarok was going to happen. It was going to happen, but it was going to happen. And then Christianity swept in and, you know, Ragnarok never happened. And I wonder if people, there was a few leftover pagans who still believe that it could have happened despite overwhelming Christianity just being overwhelmingly popular in Europe at the time.
Right. Okay. So if someone is looking for the Völuspá today, is there a particular edition? Is it worth reading, first of all, or is it worth reading as a poem, or is it more worth reading as a, you know, sort of an annotated version and more of a historical document? And how would you recommend that someone who's interested approach it? Is there a particular edition or translation that you would recommend for them?
Yeah, there's actually two really great translations, and I think it can definitely be enjoyed as a poem. Fortunately, both of the editions that I'm about to recommend are written in contemporary English. Oxford professor Caroline Larrington's translation of the Poetic Edda is really good, and you can find it anywhere, Amazon, whatever. But then Dr. Jackson Crawford of the University of Colorado Boulder has a really great translation of the Poetic Edda, and that's written in contemporary English, but even more readable, I would say, than Larrington's translation, because while hers is great, it really encompasses a lot of footnotes. So it depends what kind of person you are. But Caroline Larrington's translation or Dr. Jackson Crawford's translation?
And that reminds me, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I was hoping you could read a few of the verses so we can get a kind of a taste of it. I meant to have you do that at the beginning, but maybe that's a good way for us to conclude. Is there a passage from either of those translations that you could read for us?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me just pull it up here. So I'll just read a few stanzas then. Let me see. I'll start here. And I guess I'll go here, and I'll start with stanza 17 of the Völuspá, and this is talking about how the three gods, Odin and his two brothers, Vili and Ve, created the first humans, but then also created the universe out of the great ash tree Yggdrasil. So here we go. Three gods, powerful and passionate, left Asgard for Midgard. They found Ask and Embla, weak, fateless, in that land. They had no breath, no soul, no hair, no voice. They looked inhuman. Odin gave them breath. Hoenir gave them souls. Loth gave them their hair and human faces. I know an ash tree named Yggdrasil, a high speckled tree with white clay. Dewdrops fall from it upon the valleys. It stands forever green above Earth's well. Three wise women live there, by that well, under that tree. Earth is named one, another is Verthalndi, the third is named Skuld. They carve men's fate, and they determine destiny's laws. They choose the lifespan of every human child, and how each life will end. So that's a little bit from the Völuspá there. And of course, the three women mentioned at the end there are what are known as the Norns, and they're people who practice this magic that can alter one's destiny, and they control the fate of all people, and they live in Earth's well under the ash tree Yggdrasil.
Fascinating stuff. Okay, so the podcast is called The History of Vikings, and the guest or the host of that podcast, my guest here today, is Noah Tetzner. Noah, thank you very much for joining me today on The History of Literature.
Thank you so much, Jack. It's been a great pleasure to be here.
That's going to do it for this episode of The History of Literature. My thanks to Noah Tetzner, host of the History of Vikings podcast, for joining me today. I hope everyone checks out that podcast if you're interested in Viking culture. And I hope you come back to listen to more of our little shows, too. We have some good ones coming up. And some good ones in the archives. There's a Beowulf episode in the archives, if the Middle Ages is your thing. And all kinds of other goodies, too. If you'd like to support the show, you can find us at patreon.com/literature or historyofliterature.com/shop. Or you can sign up for our Twitter feed at @TheJackWilson. That's Jack spelled with an E. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.